Indeed, it is 5:30 p.m. here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is the V-Man. It is time for Rockin' the Boat. Today on the program, we're going to be discussing FCC consolidation hearings that are set to happen next week, Monday, June 2nd. We're also going to be discussing the fate of our media, as well as the current state of our media. Joining me first from New York will be Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Then later in the show, we're going to be hearing about a protest to take place tomorrow at KMEL in San Francisco. That's a Clear Channel station. We're going to be joined by Christy Lachlan. She works with Code Pink for Peace and is with Global Exchange. She'll be joining me at the end of the broadcast. Stand by. Stay tuned. Peter Hart joining me in just a moment. In a process that began just 2 days after 9/11, the Federal Communications Commission began a review of its media cross-ownership rules. Since the Telecommunications Act of 1996, the media has gone through a merger frenzy. Once again, on the table is an idea to allow broadcast owners to buy up many stations and newspapers in the same city, threatening the meager protections currently in place. FCC Chairman Michael Powell has kept under wraps the details of his deregulation scheme, but the fear is that rewriting these rules will open the door to a stampede of mergers, further consolidating an industry already owned and controlled by six companies. Two of the five FCC commissioners, Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps, have called for national hearings on this important issue. Chairman Powell, who agreed to one hearing in Richmond, Virginia, has steadfastly refused to hold any others. In a valiant attempt to include more of the public's voice in this process, the two dissident FCC commissioners have gone on the road without FCC approval to conduct their own public hearings. Despite their efforts, the FCC is a body of five, and the other members, Kathleen Abernathy and Kevin Martin, are Republicans. They are expected to vote with Powell to rewrite the cross-ownership rules at the FCC meeting on June 2nd. With so much at stake for the future of the media in this country, we turn now to media critic Peter Hart. He is a co-host and producer of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's radio show Counterspin, which airs here Friday mornings at 9 a.m. He also handles administrative duties and coordinates FAIR's media activism work. Peter Hart was also a member of the Paper Tiger Television Collective in New York City for a number of years and has been interviewed by a number of media outlets. He joins us by telephone now from New York City. Peter, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Here on Rockin' the Boat. Well, let's talk a little bit first about the state of our media and some recent news items concerning the very people who bring us the news. In mid-April, after the fall of Baghdad in Iraq, we had reporters and journalists who, if not actively taking part, were at least returning to the United States with the spoils of looting. Then, of course, there's the New York Times writer Jason Blair, who plagiarized from other news sources and made up quotes or whole storylines. And, of course, this isn't the first time such indiscretions have come to light about people in the media, but it is indicative of a real problem in the profession of journalism. Peter Hart, I'm wondering if you could add any thoughts about these stories. Do you see a common thread, or are these people just rotten apples, if some pundits have said?
I think they're rotten apples, but I think there's something rotten in the barrel, too. And that's what's interesting about looking at some of these stories. Jason Blair, for example, you would think, after listening to some of the coverage of this, was the first person to write a fraudulent story at the New York Times or to manufacture or concoct a story at the New York Times. In fact, they have a number of reporters who have done similar acts about stories that were much more important. The Whitewater story, the hoaxed Clinton scam land deal that eventually led to the impeachment of a president, was pushed very mightily at the New York Times by a reporter named Jeff Gerth. Jeff Gerth still works there, even though major aspects of that story turned out to be entirely false or misinterpreted by Gerth. So there are problems in journalism that go far beyond Jason Blair pretending he was in cities that he never visited and plagiarizing stories from smaller Texas newspapers. It would be a good opportunity for folks to talk about some of those big problems, but instead we're kind of focused on one man and the lying and the deceit that he practiced while being a reporter. But, you know, I think you're right about one thing, is that this should give us some chance to talk about some of the bigger problems in journalism, and one way to do that is to talk about the FCC ruling and what kind of effect it might have on the media environment as a whole.
What do you make of the treatment of Jason Blair, though? I mean, he is an African American, and as you said, there are others, but they seem to have been, you know, I mean, one guy, Mike Barnicle from Boston, got rehired somewhere else. I mean, can you talk a bit about some of these problems, i.e. the racism that underscores this story in the mainstream media?
Exactly right, and Mike Barnicle is a classic example, because Mike Barnicle was doing much the same things that Jason Blair was caught doing. The difference is that Mike Barnicle was promoted and was rehired, and I think arguably has a higher media profile now than he did before his problems. One of the most interesting things was the fact that when he was let go from the Boston Globe, he ended up at the New York Daily News, where he wrote an account of watching some of the members of the Kennedy family out sailing alone after JFK Jr. died. That turned out to have never happened, and you would think that in that environment, people in the media would say, well, we've just got a guy here who has a problem with telling the truth, and he probably should have nothing to do with journalism. Instead, he's still around, and in fact, he was hosting a television show on MSNBC. So you wonder if anyone in the media would take seriously the idea that older white men receive preferential treatment in the media because of the treatment of Mike Barnicle. That's not a conversation that anyone's having, and yet we're having a serious conversation about whether or not Jason Blair received his kind of soft treatment at the Times because he was black. I think it doesn't add up. It doesn't make any sense. If anything, Blair was an operator. He knew what he was doing. He knew how to please people, and he knew how to work the system. Had very little to do with the color of his skin. And as we know, there have been countless examples of white reporters who have done the same thing, and their whiteness never became the issue. So it does provide a unfortunate distraction from the real issues about ethics and responsibility in journalism. Instead, you have a lot of pundits talking about whether or not affirmative action and diversity in the newsroom are the real culprits here.
I think if the FCC has its way on June 2nd, if Michael Powell of the FCC has his way on June 2nd, we'll be seeing more and more stories like that. Let's talk a little bit about their hearing next week. Tell us, what's at stake? What are the rules that are in place right now, and why is this an important issue for Americans?
Yeah, it's probably the biggest review that the FCC has ever undertaken. For people who aren't following it, and it's actually kind of hard to follow unless you're paying really close attention to this, the FCC is a government agency that is charged with maintaining the public airwaves. They are a scarce and vital public resource, one that we're using right now, as a matter of fact. And the FCC dictates how licenses are awarded. In other words, Company A gets a radio station, Company B gets a TV station. The FCC is the government agency that decides how that licensing process works, since obviously many people would like to have a radio station, and certainly for a number of different reasons, whether to turn a profit or to serve a community. One of the things the FCC asks of media companies is that that companies do serve the public interest, and they have some very vague definitions about what that might mean. What we're talking about now with the FCC are a number of the rules that limit how big a media company can get. There are limits on, for example, owning a newspaper and owning a television station in the same community. The idea was that that would give one company too much power. There are also limits on how many television stations a single company could own. Again, the argument was the same. We have a scarce public resource. Why give so much control to one company? It's the same thing you would worry about with any kind of industry. Monopoly power is not good. It's not a good thing, no matter what the industry. This happens to be a very important industry, the very methods that we use to communicate with one another. So we have these rules that limit how large a media company can get, and the SEC is poised, three of its commissioners out of the five, as you mentioned at the top, they're poised to rewrite some of these rules, to soften the rules, to allow companies to do things that right now they couldn't do because it would violate some of the rules. It's a partisan decision. There are three Republicans, two Democrats, and from what we know, the Republicans are going to vote together. The Democrats, as you mentioned, will probably vote against the plan, and we'll have a 3-2 decision that's great for media companies and lousy for the rest of us who don't happen to own newspapers, TV stations, or radio stations.
We're speaking with Peter Hart, co-host of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show Counterspin. Peter, let's look at the record. 2 years ago, the FCC ended what they call the dual network rule. And so here, for example, on the Central Coast where we broadcast, our television stations are owned by one company. They own two network affiliates. They own the KCBA Fox 35 affiliate and KION Channel 46, the CBS outlet. How has this rule, this dual network rule being relaxed, affected the diversity of news content, and what can you tell us about what the statistics bear out?
It's hard to measure some of these things. You do get a sense of what's been going on in specific communities, like you mentioned. The same is generally true in New York, where you have Rupert Murdoch's News Corp operating a TV station and a TV station and a newspaper, the New York Post and Fox Channel 5. After they bought up some of the TV stations from the Chris Kraft company, which was a UPN, Chris Kraft and Viacom were involved in a media swap as well. Fox was able to purchase another TV station. So in the New York area, you have a company that owns two TV stations and a daily newspaper. What happens when they own two TV stations is that while you want to maintain some semblance of different broadcast operations between the two, in reality, the news operations are essentially merged. You have different talking heads on the newscast, but you have the same teams reporting for both channels. You have the same people researching the stories, selecting the stories. So in essence, you lose one local voice. And when you're talking about TV stations, there aren't that many local voices to begin with. That's something that has serious repercussions, losing one unique media outlet in a local community. No one could argue that's good for the community, that it serves the community better that way. It serves Rupert Murdoch better. It serves the folks who sold the TV station to him better because they made a profit. The people that lose out are the public and some of the journalists who worked at the TV station who are now out of a job because the stations were essentially merged. So the fear is you're going to see that happening across the country, and folks look to radio after 1996, after the Telecommunications Act, as really a lesson in what can happen. A radio empire was built in the space of 4 or 5 years. Clear Channel Communications went from owning a handful of stations to over 1,200. And you have to look at the effect that that's had on the diversity of music, of content, and also the political implications with their sponsorship of kind of support the war, pro-troops rallies at their stations around the country. You also look at the gutting of local public affairs at those stations. And you understand that corporate values are very different than traditional news values and community values. And what the FCC will do on June 2nd, provided that they vote the way that they're intending to vote, is that they will give those corporate values even more power in the media world. And it's hard to see where the benefit in that is going to be. It's going to be enormously beneficial to the media companies, maybe to people who own stock in some of those companies, certainly to the people who own those companies. But the rest of us are going to be left with the results. And that's the thing that's so interesting about this FCC process. very little time has been devoted to the question of why they should be doing this. I think government policy should be dictated by that. They should be able to stand in front of the American people and say, here are the benefits that relaxing these rules will have. And it's simply not the way that this policy has gone, and it's not the way the FCC works, unfortunately.
That's the voice of Peter Hart of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He's the co-host of their radio show Counterspin, and he's also a former member of the Paper Tiger TV Collective in New York. Peter Hart, we just have a few more minutes, and I have a couple questions I want to throw out at you. The Center for Public Integrity released a study called Well Connected, wherein they lay out exactly how big business has cozied up to the FCC. This study also showed how, more than any other federal agency, FCC staffers and board members took advantage of trips to conference cities and the like. This project, the Center for Public Integrity released, has as a centerpiece an online database tracking ownership and the like of over 65,000 media outlets. What do you think of this study and what it says about the FCC's true interests?
Yeah, it's a fascinating study, and I think you should direct all your listeners to track it down on the internet and to play around on that site, because it tells you a lot about how media policy is made and how, unfortunately, how our government operates. It's well known within these circles that the FCC is very tight with the industry. They travel in the same circles. People who work at the FCC often come from the media industry itself, so there's sort of a revolving door between the agency and the industry it's supposed to be watchdogging. It's terrible, really, and Bob McChesney was on our show on Counterspin one time, and he told us that the corruption is almost hard to overstate at the FCC, and I think that's exactly right, that it's hard to imagine a government agency getting away with this. The real sad fact here is that you have to stop and wonder, well, who would tell the people about what was going on at the FCC? Who would be the ones that would shine a light there? The answer is obviously that journalists would do that, that media outlets would do that. And unfortunately, because of the enormous self-interest in what goes on at the FCC, the media industry is indebted to the FCC. They're in bed with the FCC. Mm-hmm. They spend a lot of money lobbying the government and lobbying the FCC. So we're not getting any kind of picture about what goes on at the FCC. And I think that's no accident.
And that leads me right into my last question. There are those that argue, in fact, some of our listeners have even called in to say that this type of rule change that the FCC is putting forward will only make it more clear to regular, ordinary citizens of this country that there is a corporate takeover happening, and that maybe instead of traditional means of protesting this kind of activity, like letter writing and phones and fax campaigns, etc., can you address this, aside from what we're doing, seizing open frequencies illegally? What other ways can you suggest to people to combat this corporatization of our media?
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned Free Radio Santa Cruz, because that movement, pirate radio, if you want to call it that, free radio, or radio for the people, that movement demonstrated that you could lobby and you could write to the FCC, but more important than that, you had to take immediate and sometimes drastic action to put that issue on the table. And it's something that we at FAIR have always pointed out, that those airwaves didn't open up because people decided to kindly petition the FCC and go through the process. People risked arrest, people were arrested, people were harassed by the government, and eventually beat down a lot of these powerful interests in Washington. It's an amazing, fascinating, wonderful success story, and that's the kind of inspiration that we need to find. There is a corporate takeover of government. There is a corporate takeover of the media. It's certainly not a stretch to say that. The evidence all bears that out, that the trends in media ownership have been going that way. The influence of corporate money in politics is absolutely undeniable, and it will likely take aggressive, focused media activism, and that's the kind of thing that I think we'll see in the future. The the heartening part about this, and you know, folks shouldn't think that June 2nd is the end of this story by a long shot. We have engaged now in a great grassroots public education campaign about this issue through community radio and through some of the traditional activist channels. And I think the awareness of what has gone on and what's going on at the FCC is so much greater than it was in 1996. There's a lot of momentum and there's a lot of enthusiasm. So I think that after June 2nd will be the real test of how the energy of media activists is put to the test. So I would, you know, encourage people to look beyond this vote and look for the next battle. It's going to come, and you never know how these things will shake out.
That's Peter Hart. He's the co-host of Counterspin, aired here each week on Friday mornings at 9 a.m. and at random times throughout the week as well. Peter, your website's fair.org. Thanks for joining us today on Rockin' the Boat. I really appreciate your knowledge and input.
My pleasure. Keep up the good work.
And we'll keep in touch about this issue in future broadcasts. And indeed, you're tuned in to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is the V-Man. This is Rockin' the Boat. And in just a few minutes, I'm going to be joined on the phone by Christy Laughlin. Stand by. Stay tuned.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae.
And indeed, you're tuned in to Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. My name is the V-Man, and right now I'm joined by Christy Laughlin. She works with Code Pink for Peace and is the Peace Campaign Coordinator at Global Exchange, the San Francisco-based human rights organization. Her group has spearheaded a Bay Area rally at a Clear Channel station, KMEL, and that is scheduled to coincide with protests in other cities around the country in preparation for Monday's FCC hearing. Christy Laughlin, thanks for joining us here today.
Great to be with you.
Tell us a little bit first about why Clear Channel? Why did you pick this particular group? Obviously, they own 1,200 radio stations, but what is it that you feel Clear Channel is doing that your voices are not being heard?
Well, there's in this day and age, there's lots of other media outlets we could choose, but Clear Channel, I think, really exemplifies everything that is wrong with media deregulation. As you stated, it is owns already 1,200 stations nationwide. It's the largest. World's largest radio broadcaster, and also concert promoter and billboard advertising firm. So Clear Channel for us exemplifies monopoly practices that reduces the diversity of information and flow of information that we hear on our airwaves. And so we think with Clear Channel, the way they work, they end up, all our information is homogenized in cookie-cutter style radio that really limits people's voices and people's access to real information. And we really think it's really dangerous for a democracy like ours, that when democracy is dependent on people's access to information.
What do you know about Clear Channel's connections to the Bush family?
That's another important fact and maybe a little known fact about Clear Channel is, you know, we also, I think, expect more, you know, our media to be more objective and nonpartisan, but Clear Channel actually has a real conservative political agenda And as you're probably referring to recent headlines and articles that did reveal that they are actually responsible for sponsoring pro-war rallies called Rally for America, held in many cities around the country in recent months. In fact, they just had one this past weekend in West Virginia. And so they keep at it. So we do see really frightening links, I think, with a conservative political agenda with Clear Channel. That is also a danger, I think, again, to democracy. And what we really face with more media deregulation is corporations winning and the people and public interest losing.
So, Christy Loughlin, tell us what's in store tomorrow, May 29th. You're scheduled to protest out in front of the studio of KMEL, which is a Clear Channel station. Give us an idea of, you know, this is in coordination with other cities around the country, but give us an idea of what's going to be taking place. What are you going to be calling for out in the studios? And what time? Give us some details about where and
sure. Well, here in San Francisco, we are calling for people to join us in a protest at 5 o'clock at their offices, 340 Townsend Street, and that's south of Market. And as you mentioned, there's other protests in Los Angeles and at least 7 other cities in New York, D.C., Pittsburgh, Portland, Oregon, and so it's coordinated effort to highlight, again, this FCC deregulation agenda that will be voted on in June next week. So we're asking people to come out in front of their offices and protest, make their voices heard across the country.
Again, we're speaking with Christy Loughlin with Code Pink for Peace and with Global Exchange, talking a bit about the media and Clear Channel. We just have about 2 minutes left, Christy, and I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are about this particular proposal by the FCC and how it has kind of drawn in support from a wide range of groups that are sort of coordinating together to oppose the FCC. You have right-wingers, Christian groups, people from the NRA, and like groups like your organization, Code Pink for Peace, and others. What do you think about the prospects there for breaking down some walls amongst different...
You see such an alliance, a broad-based alliance, because the people do realize that, you know, this is a fight for democracy, that fighting for our public airwaves is vital for a nation, a democratic nation. And so you see this broad, albeit a little bizarre, coalition of people coming together. But it isn't, you know, it's in a very important agenda to actually liberate our airwaves or reclaim them, really, because that they are supposed to be, you know, for the public and not supposed to be owned by corporations. And this is the agenda right now that we see on the table with the FCC. And it's not surprising or probably not incidental that it's Michael Powell, who is the chairman of the FCC. Perhaps you addressed that in your earlier segment, you know, that Colin Powell's son is the head of the FCC. So again, we see linkages between a political agenda of the Bush administration and what is happening to our media, our airwaves. So we do see peace groups, faith-based groups, conservative groups all hopefully uniting behind the protection of what should be a public resource.
Christy Loughlin, we're fresh out of time. Can you just give us quickly a website where folks can get more information about tomorrow's demonstration and maybe some other websites that you think are good to read for alternative
viewpoints? Sure. For updates, I do recommend checking the United for Peace, www.unitedforpeace.org, and also Code Pink, www.codepinkalert.org for information on the protests.
CodePinkAlert.org. I want to thank you for joining us here tonight on Rockin' the Boat, and we'll hopefully send some of our listeners out to see you tomorrow.
Great. I appreciate that. Thanks
right.
so much.
Bye-bye. And indeed, that's going to do it for tonight here.
This is not a rebel song.
Rockin' the Boat, V-Man, signing out.
We're with Clear Channel. You can't bloody stop us. Act on, baby.